Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Years since the death of Diana and the 11th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, why we can't rely on our mainstream press anymore to do the right thing. And the Arab Spring has met a big turnaround for Egypt. Or has it? New President Mohamed Morsi has sacked some of the top generals, but then he went back to take the NATO position and attack the Syrian regime in a speech last weekend. We try and untangle the truth behind the smoke screens in Egypt. Plus, See No Evil is one of Bristol's most successful city centre arts events ever. But how much public money went into the project and where did it all go? We talked to one city centre proprietor that wants some answers. Also, Saddam, Gaddafi and Bashar al-Assad, all Arab leaders who've been accused of bombing their own people, where the Israelis and NATO wanted to go in and have already gone in some cases in humanitarian missions to save the people, with disastrous results, with civilian casualties well into the millions. But is this idea of killing your own people something that originated here in the West? We hear more this week from former Fleet Street journalist and former Tory member of the European Parliament for Bristol, Richard Cotterill, as he takes us further into NATO's darkest secret, Operation Gladio, which he's just written a book all about. Plus the latest from around the world with Old Labour Oxford economist, and particularly Syria, Martin Summers. But we start this week with Dan Glazebrook and Egypt. Now, despite Britain's economic warfare, bureaucrats seizing the assets of Saddam Hussein in Iraq, Colonel Gaddafi in Libya and Bashar al-Assad in Syria in a matter of minutes, the same is not true for Egypt. 18 months ago, the government here agreed to seize all former President Hosni Mubarak Circle's ill-gotten gains. They got the billions of dollars through Mubarak's privatising Egypt's state's assets and selling them off cheap to his friends. Of course, that could never happen in here in Britain, could it? Anyhow, this does raise questions about whether Britain is running a shadow foreign policy, and can we believe anything the Treasury and Foreign Office say on such matters? So to discuss this in the context of Egypt, Mubarak and the Arab Spring, I'm joined on the line by freelance political journalist Dan Glazebrook. Hi Dan, welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, thank you.
Now, first of all, Dan, how would you characterise the West's relationship with previous President Mubarak?
Well, this is interesting. I mean, Mubarak was classically characterised by the left here with a lot of reason as basically a kind of puppet of the West. His reputation reached a kind of nadir around the time of the Israeli bombing of Gaza, which was also known in the Arab world as the Mubarak Massacre, because he basically sealed the borders, didn't let any Palestinians flee Gaza into Egypt, and also didn't let any Egyptians in to go and help the Gazans. He received money for the U.S. as Egypt did, as Sadat did before him, since 1979, since the Egyptian peace deal with Israel. That money now stands at about $1.3 billion a year military funding. So he was classically seen as a kind of paid-off strongman working on behalf of the West, which I would largely go along with that, except what was interesting is that if you look more closely at Egypt's foreign policy in the latter days of, or the latter years of Mubarak's rule, that he was definitely doing some things that were not to the liking of the Western power structure. There was a UN report, interestingly, in 2006, I think, that he was actually training the Islamic Courts Union, at which time the U.S. at that time was desperately trying to overthrow in Somalia. So he was funding their enemies. He was developing closer ties with Gaddafi, and was kind of tension was easing between Egypt and Iraq. Egypt and Iran. So it looked like his foreign policy was starting to become more independent of the Western diktat, which obviously was not to the liking of the West. So I think it's I think the picture is slightly more complicated than has classically been portrayed by the left over here with Mubarak. It's interesting as well, his chief of staff, Tantawi, who was just recently sacked by the new president, Morsi, WikiLeaks revealed some cables in which revealed some quite serious dissatisfaction on the part of the U.S. ambassador with Tantawi, who was actually resisting, using his influence in the cabinet to resist a lot of the kind of privatization that you mentioned. He was against that, and he was actually, Mubarak was pushed a lot of it through, but Tantawi prevented some of it. So there were some elements within the Egyptian regime that were certainly not to the liking of what the West was trying to do there domestically and in terms of foreign policy. And one last thing is worth mentioning is that Mubarak is definitely not quite cut from the same cloth as the kind of classic Arab monarchs. You know, Egypt is not a monarchy. The state of Egypt that developed, that Mubarak came out of, that kind of tradition, that movement, was the Nasserite kind of anti-colonial tradition dating back to the overthrow by Nasser of the British imposed king of Egypt in the 50s. So he, you know, and Mubarak was famously fought in the 1973 war against Israel and so on. So he's not, unlike places like Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Kuwait, he's not from a family that was just literally hand-picked and put in charge by the British under the empire. He's from a tradition that is an anti-colonial independent tradition, however bought off it may have subsequently become. And that is something now, I think, that that the West are kind of trying to push back. That's how I would characterize it, really.
Okay, Dan. I mean, Martin Summers, if I can just bring you in here. I mean, this business, just one thing, for example, that Mubarak was funding was this thing called the Islamic Courts Union in Somalia. I mean, we've got a big Somali population in Bristol, and I remember when we had the people from Somali Voice on, they were saying that this was actually a beacon of hope in their country. So could you just tell us a little bit about how significant that was and what the whole sort of geopolitical situation is in Somalia and why something like that might have to be stopped by the Western powers?
Well, I mean, the Islamic Courts Union was certainly not a liberal regime, but of course what people were looking for in Somalia and Mogadishu at the time was an end to clan violence. And basically things had stabilised under the Islamic Courts Union, but the West, as was pointed out by our contributor there, was completely hostile to them. Mubarak, of course, was, like many puppets, so-called puppets in the Third World, was trying to establish some kind of independence. And you can see Karzai doing similar things in Afghanistan. Of course, he wasn't properly elected. He is a puppet. But on the other hand, puppets tend to rebel because they have to in order to keep credibility with their own people. And this kind of tension is consistent across time and space.
Sounds much more complicated than we're led to believe. Anyway, Dan,
most things are.
Dan, what do you think the West then was complicit in removing Mubarak from power? I mean, we obviously, you know, the idea is that it was the Arab Spring that removed him. It was their own people over in Egypt that removed him. What do you think was the West's actual real attitude to Mubarak?
Well, I mean, that's interesting. I mean, I would argue Mubarak is someone who was basically, he was a status quo man, right? So he inherited this peace deal with Israel, negotiated by his predecessor Sadat, and I would argue that he was not a revolutionary. He was not up for pushing back the influence of the old colonial empires of Western imperialism. He was not up for, you know, kind of attacking Israel or pushing out Western influence from the Arab world, but at the same time he wasn't really up for facilitating the extension of kind of empire's plots and things. So I think it would have been difficult for the attack on Libya to have gone ahead with Mubarak in charge. I think that would have been difficult, and the attack that's now going on in Syria, because remember, you know, the Egyptian regime, like I was saying, emerged out of this anti-colonial Nasserist kind of secular nationalist Arab nationalist tradition, which is the same tradition that that threw up the Ba'ath Party in Syria, Assad's party in Syria, and a similar kind of tradition as threw up Gaddafi in Libya. So I don't think Mubarak would have been up for kind of facilitating that, and I think it would have been difficult. So was the West complicit? Well, we saw the attitude of the West. It was kind of umming and ahhing. I think they played their hand very well, actually, the Western powers, which is when they play their cards well, that's to the detriment of the rest of us, and to the rest of the world, because what they did was I think they saw it coming. I mean, there was this idea that kind of Arab Spring came out of the blue. Personally, I think that's nonsense. If you read some of the kind of analysis and things, there was widespread predictions of a lot of unrest.
Dan, I think we're losing you there. Maybe you could just give us a call back. But in the meantime, Mark Martin, what are your thoughts then about what Dan's been saying? And was this Arab Spring? Was it something spontaneous?
The fact of the matter is, these are very complex social events, and the historians will no doubt be raking over the documents and interviews with people who were involved for decades to come in order to understand what was happening. Most of these kind of events are a bit of both. They are spontaneous, but they're also directed. Don't forget, there's lots of people who've got an interest in the outcome of these kind of struggles, one way or another, and they've all got their intelligence agencies and journalists and others banging away trying to drag the situation in the direction they want it to go. I mean, Morsi is doing, you know, the new president of Egypt is doing some things which the West doesn't like he went to Iran the other day when the West was saying he shouldn't go, but when he got there he told the Iranians what the West wanted to hear, which is that Assad had to go. So you know, the jury's out on where all this is going.
We've got Dan back again, I hope. Dan, what do you make of the idea that Morsi's leadership might herald a move away from Washington then?
I mean, that's clearly not true, and I think he's kind of made that clear now. I mean, there was some speculation. It's interesting how much it was hyped. Some elements of the mainstream media, the Washington Post said the fact that Morsi was going to China before going to the U.S., the fact that he was putting an appearance at the Non-Aligned Movement Summit in Tehran, in Iran, last week, all of this was a kind of showed a potential shifting allegiance away from the U.S. and the West and towards Iran and China. I don't think this stands up to any serious scrutiny. If we look at what Morsi actually said in Iran, well, he was nailed his colors clearly to NATO's mast on regime change in Syria. He said there's no chance for reform. He's completely against negotiation. He just says Assad must go, the government must disappear in Syria, and so on. And I think actually there's a move to try, and he's trying to paint himself as less of a kind of messenger boy for Hillary Clinton and these kinds of people than he actually is. He is basically acting, I think, as the figurehead for the next installment of the West kind of regime change policy. They've failed so far.
That's interesting. But I mean, he's come up with this thing called the Syria Contact Group. This is Morsi's idea, apparently. What's that all about?
So the contact group, the idea is Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Iran and Egypt will all meet with Syria to try and decide the way forward for Syria. It seems to me like this plan is clearly set up to fail. What I mean by that is that Turkey, Saudi Arabia and Egypt, three quarters of that contact group, have already made it very clear which side they're on. They're up for complete destruction of the Syrian state, backing the rebels, arming every kind of sectarian group they can find, and they're facilitating all this. They're waging war against Syria, sending their people in and aiding the armed Syrian rebels. So they've made it very clear. So I think the idea is that they want to try and basically bully Iran into dropping its support for Assad. And if Iran doesn't do that, which it almost certainly won't, then the idea is, well, then they can paint Iran as this one, you know, blocking the only chance for peace and et cetera, et cetera. So I think it's set up to fail in order to then point the finger at Iran. Again, at part of also whipping up the kind of war frenzy against Iran. This is increasingly on the table, the idea of this strike on Iran. So if they can say that, look, Iran is causing all the damage in Syria, preventing a peaceful negotiated solution and so on, it's nonsense. But if that could be another kind of tool in their propaganda armory to use against Iran.
One thing, though, Dan, is that we've seen, for example, border crossings opened under Morsi that hadn't been beforehand. We're seeing some really positive signs coming out, freedom of movement of individuals which had been stopped under the previous Mubarak regime.
Yeah, well, anything like that, you know, that's to be welcomed. But I think if we're looking at the bigger picture, the real big picture is that the foreign policy, in which, like I say, Morsi is acting as the figurehead for Western-backed proxy war against Syria. And, you know, this is no small thing. This proxy war that the West is waging against Syria, as we've seen, has cost, you know, something like nearly 20,000 lives. You've got no chance of Syria becoming a stable state again anytime soon. That country is being destroyed before our eyes, and it's not being destroyed primarily by the Syrian government, but by the militias, the sectarian militias that have been sent in to destroy the place, and are doing so very effectively. The other area which Morsi is singing from the same song sheet as the Western elites is on economy of Egypt. The Muslim Brotherhood, his organization, have an economic strategy document called the Renaissance. The Renaissance is a severely neoliberal document. It aims to cut all of it's currently $10 billion per year annual food and fuel subsidies that are a lifeline for Egypt's poor, he's planning to cut all of that. He's planning to privatize large swathes of industry that are not already privatized, and he's planning to take an IMF loan of $4.5 billion that would kind of force even more privatization, even more of this neoliberal agenda onto Egypt. So I think, you know, we have to see the big picture. This is going to be devastating. This is going to result in hundreds of thousands of tragedies for Egyptian people and for Syrian people. So any other positive moves, you know, are to be welcomed. We need to see it in perspective with the damage that could be potentially done by his economic and foreign policy.
It doesn't sound like these rallies in Tahrir Square are quite over yet, does it, from what you're saying? Dan, can you just wind up by telling us whereabouts we can find some of your work? I know you're one of the writers for The New Statesman, but whereabouts else can we find your work?
Good question. I've done quite a few things recently for Counterpunch. There's another website called Countercurrents that publishes some of my stuff. Also Z Magazine. I've had a couple publishing there. And in the Morning Star, they're the main places that publish my work at the moment.
All right, Dan Glazebrook, thank you very much for joining us on Drive Time this evening. And Martin, can you just explain? I mean, Dan is really, what he's saying there essentially is that there's been some sort of weird kaleidoscope going on with the Arab Spring in Egypt, and that what we may be seeing is actually a more pro-Western regime than even Mubarak was. Even though he had his business contacts with the West, he still, it seemed, his heart wasn't quite... It was halfway between the West and the Arab world, that he didn't actually want to see a lot of change.
Well, that's right. I mean, basically, there is an awful lot going on out there. The West, you can imagine, any change in the political situation in a major country like Egypt is of major interest to the major powers, to the Israelis, to the British, to the Americans, and so on. And, you know, just because there's been a change of personnel at the top in Egypt doesn't mean that the interests of the people outside Egypt have changed. And Morsi, don't forget, Egypt, like most third world countries, is massively in debt. So Morsi, even though he's been elected by the people, or perhaps not, I've heard it suggested that he didn't actually win, but we won't go into that. Basically, the West is going to try and influence their policy, and they're going to find all sorts of ways to do it. And you either go along with that, or with a good grace, or you try and resist it. And even if you try and resist, look at this attack, but supposedly by Al Qaeda type militants in Sinai some weeks ago, where they all escaped, but then the Egyptian armed forces then supposedly killed loads of these terrorists in Sinai. That, I mean, the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood website was very clear about that. We think that is Mossad. Now, of course, Middle England doesn't think like that, but Middle England don't know much. I mean, it's quite likely it was Mossad. So we've got false flag terrorism steering the Egyptian semi-democracy in the direction the big boys want it to go. No change there then.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Now, I said at the top of the hour, we were going to be looking at anniversaries. 15 years since the death of Diana last weekend, and it's the 11th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks next week. So we'll look at some of the reasons both of these events need urgent reassessment and why we can't rely on our mainstream press anymore, really, to do the right thing. Martin, starting with Diana, Sherard Cowper-Coles has been named as the MI6 guy in Paris who was actually organising the Diana assassination back 15 years ago. In this book by John Morgan. Now, Morgan has gone through the Paget inquiry, which was the British inquiry, the French police inquiry into the death of Diana, and through all of the submissions to the inquest, which happened 10 years afterwards, and he's come up with this name, various other names. For example, he believes that she was mistreated in the ambulance by two doctors. The ambulance took an extraordinarily long time to get to the hospital, and also apparently went to the wrong hospital, because there was a much better equipped hospital, much closer to the crash scene. So who is this guy Sherard Cowper-Coles? What do you know about him?
He was at one stage Britain's proconsul, as it were, in Afghanistan.
He was also, I can tell you, another job he took. I mean, his career absolutely took off, skyrocketed after 1998 for whatever reason. He was also an ambassador to Israel for a while.
Well, yes, he's very much an establishment figure. And, of course, the allegations in the book that you name are things that people ought to pay attention to. Does the British state go around killing people? My answer to that is unequivocally yes.
Well, one of the
Did
people-
they kill Diana? I don't know.
Well, one of the people who he dedicates the book to is Peter Wright, who wrote Spycatcher, ironically another book that was published in Australia originally. I mean, this book, though you can get it here too, the Diana book is called The Paris-London Connection, The Assassination of Princess Diana. It's about 160 pages long, very accessible, and certainly awfully referenced. There's absolutely loads of references in there. So that's one anniversary to deal with. Next week, we've got the anniversary of the 11th attacks 11 years ago. Tell us a bit about Reinvestigate 9/11.
Well, I'm one of the founders of Reinvestigate 9/11, which is a British-based organisation campaigning for a full independent inquiry into what happened on the day. We've been around for a few years now. We organise conferences in London. If you go to the web, you'll find some video of our conferences. And we work with colleagues in other countries to raise questions about what happened. And there's a mountain of evidence to suggest that this was not what it seems.
Well, I spoke to one of your colleagues who runs the website for Reinvestigate 9/11 about why it is that we should be looking back at 9/11 after all this time. Surely, you know, we know exactly what happened, don't we? So anyway, I had a chat to her a couple of weeks ago.
My name is Fran Anderson. I'm a member of the Reinvestigate 911 campaign group. We're campaigning, along with many people around the world, for a truly proper, independent, scientific investigation into the 9/11 attacks.
Now, who founded the campaign in Britain?
Annie Matchon, who's ex-MI5 whistleblower, who wrote a book, and also Ian Henshaw, book author of 9/11 Revealed. Recently, June the 20th, 2012, this year, new CIA documents were released, and it shows that Bush ignored 7 senior CIA intelligence briefs that warned about the 9/11 attacks, including details of the exact targets and the correct time frame. And there seems to be a blame game going on here, because also ex-FBI special agent on terrorism Ali Soufan, who wrote a book called Black Banners, Inside Story of 9/11 and the War Against Al-Qaeda, claims that the CIA wasn't willing to share vital information with him, and if they had, he could have stopped the 9/11 attacks. The CIA finally gave him a file, actually on the day of September 11th, with the information in it that could have prevented the attacks. So the CIA are blaming the Bush administration, and the FBI are blaming the CIA. But Ali Soufan is also backed up by Richard Clarke, ex-White House terror czar. Around September 2011, He accused the CIA of deliberately suppressing information before the 9/11 attacks. And, quote, high-level decisions in the CIA were ordering people not to share information. End of quote. That's Richard Clarke, who was interviewed by the same people who produced 9/11 Press for Truth DVD. Also, if we go back a little bit, John O'Neill was the FBI's top expert on terrorism, and he was forced to resign in summer 2001 because he kept warning about imminent attacks.
Now, he was actually very high up, wasn't he? He was the deputy director of the FBI.
So he resigned in disgust, and then he got a job as head of security for the World Trade Center and unfortunately died in the attacks that he was specifically trying to warn against. Apart from this, we also have a number of FBI whistleblowers complaining about being consistently blocked by the CIA prior to 9/11. And we also have a long list of experts now. They are featured on a DVD that's not long out called Explosive Evidence, 9/11 Experts Speak Out. And this contains people such as architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth, military officers, pilots, intelligence officers, scholars for 9/11 Truth, a whole host of scientists coming out and saying why they are questioning the 9/11 official account, and with very detailed rational arguments. And I recommend that DVD. Something that people may not be aware of is that immediately after the 9/11 attacks, when planes had been downed and no planes were allowed to fly, the only plane allowed to fly out of America was the family of the chief suspect, Bin Laden himself. So how come his family were allowed to fly out and nobody else was? And yet he was the chief suspect. You'd think that they should have been rounded up, arrested, questioned about Osama bin Laden if he's the chief suspect. But there's hardly been any mention in the mainstream media about that issue. When you dig a little bit deeper, then you find that the Bush family and the Bin Laden family have had many business dealings for quite some time. We're living in a post 9/11 world, and in the words of Gore Vidal, we're in a situation of perpetual war, perpetual peace. And his book has got scant mention, and we're having our civil liberties clamped down, more and more snooping done on our activities, and constant war, all because of 9/11. So that's why we're calling for another investigation. And if people think the Department of Homeland Security is fixing the so-called incompetencies of the CIA and FBI for not joining up their information, then you've got another thing coming. The Department of Homeland Security being overly intrusive and putting anti-war activists, 9/11 skeptics, environmentalists, a whole list of people on terror suspect lists in the US.
Well, that sounds like a pretty good reason to actually do a proper investigation into the 9/11 attacks, Martin. Can you give us an idea of how far you're getting with actually getting a proper investigation? Because in the old days, it used to be the job of people like Panorama and World in Action and This Week and these kind of investigative documentaries. They would focus in on something like this, and they'd give us all a balanced idea, wouldn't they, of what had actually happened?
Not necessarily. If you think about Gladio, Tony, the only coverage of Gladio on British TV was Frankovich's three films for BBC Two, which were done in the Time Watch strand.
You've just made my point for me. At least, I mean, there was some coverage on television back sort of 20 years ago for these sorts of things.
Yeah, but you've got to understand that this is psychological warfare. So what you do is you carry out the attack and then you fill people's heads with what they're supposed to think about it. And there's not been any proper investigation by senior journalists into any of this, apart from in foreign countries. And of course, with the web now, we're very well aware of all sorts of things going on which we weren't aware of in a previous generation. So if people are interested in the evidence, they should go to the Reinvestigate 9/11 website, because it's all very, very carefully vetted. There's no speculation on that website. It's all factual material, and it's all related to the attacks and the cover-up that followed.
I mean, one of the people who, right from the very start, was investigating what happened on 9/11 was looking at the military software which was being used by NORAD, and that's the North American Air Defense Department, who were actually in charge of defending the United States. And one of the things that they found out was that a lot of the operating systems that this software was running on had kind of access points in. And Chris Bolin pointed out that when you're buying the software, you could also be buying a vulnerability, say, for example, from another country, to actually get access into your air defense systems by a backdoor, by a software backdoor.
Well, yes. I mean, that's one of the sorts of evidence that have been covered. I mean, Chris Bolin is very interesting because he goes into a lot of detail about who he thinks did it and how it was done. But Alan Sabrowski is a very interesting character. He blogs on in Veterans Today, which is a US publication. He's an ex-US military guy. He used to be a lieutenant colonel in the Marines. He used to head up the US Army War College. And as he pointed out in his recent stuff on Veterans Today, one of the problems with why the 9/11 movement hasn't got proper traction is because people at an early stage of questioning are overfaced with too much information. Basically, the sort of level of information about, you know, software being infiltrated and so on, that's really for professional journalists and intelligence officers. What I ask people listening to this program is just ask themselves two simple questions. This is what Sabrowski does. Do people know that a third building collapsed on the day, WTC-7? Well, it did, and no plane crashed into it. So the story about how planes caused fires which caused the buildings to collapse can't be true for the third building. It's not true for the other two buildings either, but it can't be true for the third building. All you've got to do is do a computer search, WTC-7, and you'll see the video of it coming down into its own footprint at free fall speed, even though a plane hadn't hit it. The second question people need to ask themselves, where was the United States Air Force for an hour and a half on September the 11th? In the 1940s, after an alert, it took the British RAF maybe 2 or 3 minutes to get airborne. For an hour and a half, planes are flying not directly to the targets, but around and around inside US airspace, and not one of them is intercepted. Why? And all these years later, 11 years later, after an inquiry, we should be able to know. Heads should have rolled. Where was the Air Force? We know where the Air Force was. In actual fact, it was stood down. Who stood it down? Well, you'll have to go to the Reinvestigate 9/11 website if you want to find those kind of things out. People shouldn't overface themselves with too much investigation of the detail. Just stick to the big picture. It's pretty clearly an inside job. And that's what General Ivashov, who is the commander of the Russian armed forces on the day, says. Go to his website.
Yeah, this is another point, isn't it? It's actually different parts of the world have different perceptions of the same event now because they're spoken to by different TV networks.
Absolutely. But if people just take one step back and clear their minds a little, the Western intelligence services have a track record of engaging in false flag terrorism. Look at Bologna bomb, Gladio. This, therefore, 9/11 doesn't come out of the blue. It's part of an established pattern of behaviour by the Western intelligence services. And that is well understood by the Russian general staff. And it's a fact that people need to get on board. The Russian general staff are pretty much convinced that it was an inside job. Now, that means whether it was or it wasn't, they are making their deployments accordingly, which is why Putin is taking such a hard line with the West, because he thinks they're gangsters and criminals. He's right, but then so is he.
Finally, then, this book, the latest book out by Chris Bolin, is called Solving 9/11. He has chapters in there, for example, about the destruction of the evidence and making sense of the 9/11 cover-up, the sort of stuff you were talking about there, Martin.
Yes, but I mean, don't overface yourself. Go and look at some of the more straightforward material first. Chris Bolin is a very, very serious investigative reporter, and it's very, very detailed stuff. What some people don't like is he points the finger very squarely at the Israelis, as do the Russian general staff and Sabrowski, incidentally, as well as being a top US military guy, retired now, is also a Jew. He's quite clear that it was the Israelis who were the main culprits.
But what might be the motive if it was the Israelis?
Because it started the wars which Israel wanted. Israel is saying every day they want a war with Iran. And they were wanting a war with Iran 15 years ago, except nobody was listening then, before these nasty things happened. Now, we could go into lots of details, and on this programme we have gone into a lot of detail about the questions that have to be asked about 9/11. But I ask people to keep it simple. Why did the third building collapse? Where was the Air Force? And once you've answered those questions, which are unanswerable, you can look at more of the complex detail. It looks like a CIA Israeli operation.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Well, on a related topic is Syria. Citizen journalist Gary Sullivan is going to be in Bristol next week doing a talk all about Syria. And he's actually been to Syria, one of the few of us who's not got all of his information from places like the BBC and CNN. Hi, Gary, I hope you're there, and welcome to Drive Time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Gary, can you just give us a bit about your background and how long you've actually been in Syria? When have you been there?
Yeah, I've actually been four times in the last 5 years. I went 2 years before any of this crisis really happened. And, you know, and it's a great country. It's a really peaceful, kind, loving country. It's very European, certainly on the west coast. Not many people realize that it's actually on the Mediterranean Sea. So it's got very kind of European feel about it. And then I've been 2 years since the crisis. I went last year in 2011 for about 3 weeks. And this time I've been 9 weeks. Just came back about a month ago.
What's your own perception then about the? Is it true to say that there's a difference between what we're getting on the TV here, places like Channel 4 News, BBC News, and what you saw is actually happening on the ground?
Yeah, and the simplest possible answer is yes. The key factor here is exactly how much different it is, and I think people don't really grasp how much misinformation is actually being said about Syria and possibly, you know, elsewhere. I mean, it's very interesting what you've been saying about the whole deception of 9/11. And certainly when I was traveling through Syria, it felt to me like it was a completely different country than was being reported on the BBC and you know, American broadcasters and now in newspapers as well. And it is very slanted towards the rebels. They try to make it out that it's a very black and white, simplistic thing, that it's the government versus the people of Syria. But they don't tell the full story. They make it very, very simplistic. And when they do talk to people in Syria, they tend to talk to those who are very much against the government. They don't tell you that about 70 to 90% of the population like the government, like Assad to some extent. You know, I mean, it's like here. Not everybody likes the prime minister, but not everybody likes the opposition. So, you know, there's various shades of grey throughout any kind of political opinion. And that's the same in Syria as it is here.
Now, Vladimir Putin was talking about Syria this week in one of his occasional long TV interviews that he did. That's the Russian president. So let's have a listen to what he had to say.
I believe that the first thing to do is to stop shipping arms into the war zone, which is still going on. We should stop trying to impose unacceptable solutions on either side, because it is a dead end. That's what we should do. It's that simple.
Well, there's Vladimir Putin putting his point of view. I saw a rebel interviewed in Aleppo, and he said, well, one of the problems we've got is 70% of the people of Aleppo don't support us. And that was out of the mouth of a rebel.
Yeah. And I've heard that quote as well. I've had exactly the same quote, the exact same figure said to me from a rebel in Latakia. And he was a Christian, and actually Christian rebels are very, very rare in Syria. So, yeah, I would definitely say that there is a strong support of Assad to some level. When you actually pose the question, do you prefer Assad or do you prefer Western intervention, that figure rises to something like 90-95%.
Well, I think this is, it's very hard for people outside a situation to understand what's happening. And also, it's also hard for the people of Britain to understand that they are being deliberately lied to, because this is a psychological warfare game. So they keep saying Assad is bad, everybody hates him. But in actual fact, it's not true. But of course, saying it enough could make it true, because these kind of lies are part of the war game, aren't they?
Absolutely. And, you know, your last question, your last talker invited two questions, and I've got two questions as well. Ask yourself, why is it that the BBC and other broadcasters never broadcast the voice of President Assad? Why do we never actually hear him speak? And I think the reason for that is because we would have to translate what he says, and most of the people, particularly when he talks about Palestine and Israel, most of the people in this country would actually sit and listen to him and say, actually, yeah, you know, I agree with you. But also we would get to hear something of his body language, hear something of his tone, and he would come across as somebody who is quite astute, quite intellectual, quite reserved. He's actually quite a very calming man, and that's the aura that he gives out. And the second question is, why do we never get interviewed the people of the of the country. It's always the rebels on one side who are very much against the government. And then when they talk about somebody who is pro-government, it's always somebody from the government. But they never talk to doctors, they never talk to shopkeepers or students or just ordinary people and get their opinion. So there's my two questions. Why do we never hear the voice of the president? Why do they never talk to an ordinary person in Syria who isn't necessarily for or against the government, just an ordinary person getting on with their lives?
Okay, Gary, can you tell us finally then whereabouts you're speaking next week and when?
Hamilton Hall, which is on Stokes Road. It starts at...
Hang on. It's Hamilton House on Stokes Croft.
You're not from Yes, sorry. I'm from Newcastle, so I don't really know the area. I did have it all written down, but yes, so that's it. Thank you very much for advising me on that. It starts at 7 o'clock, and because I've been to Syria, I've got a lot of exclusive footage that I'm going to be there that you've never seen before, and it should be quite a very interesting story about what is really going on in Syria, and you'll certainly see it from a different point of view than you're seeing from the TV.
Okay, just to remind you, that is next Thursday evening, 7 p.m. at Hamilton House on Stokes Croft. Gary Sullivan, thanks very much for joining us. Last-minute affair this evening.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Drive Time on BC FM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Now, as I said at the top of the hour, we have some questions to ask about See No Evil, which is the recent arts extravaganza in Bristol City Centre with loads of graffiti going on. And Eddie is joining me now. He's one of the proprietors of one of the shops in the city centre. Eddie, would you like to just tell us a little bit about your experience of this event?
Well, first I need to go into the history of how this event started. Basically, it started last year with See No Evil Part 1. The idea of that was to bring the property values up in that particular street. In other words, it was a bit of they saw it as a bit of a no-go area, a bit of a dead end, just where buses and taxis go. John Hurst, who's the director of Destination Bristol, who was also part of the consortium that gave us Cabot Circus. He first embarked on the first No Evil, See No Evil, and basically it was, as I said, to raise the level of interest in that particular street. It was really about property values as much as anything else. And then the first block party was evidently a major success. There was fantastic graffiti down there, and but what we did notice was the amount of street drinking and drugs, etc., etc. It appeared to be a street party totally unlicensed, and we more or less witnessed the same thing in the second No Evil. But we have actually just found out that we don't think they had either a drinks or an entertainment license in place for this particular event, but we are checking on that. But the wider issue is the question of the money. Evidently, £250,000 of Olympiad money was given to this project, which is basically what I consider is to raise the profile of the property in the area, and of course done wonderful for the artists that participated in that.
Now, can I just butt in there? Because, I mean, for a lot of people, they will walk down these now graffitied streets and think they look absolutely dreadful. They won't necessarily be the sort of person that will say, oh, I like my concrete just grey. But the actual flavour of this artwork does not appeal to everybody, does it?
No, and secondly, there are very good local artists. I mean, the Banksy type of art, had a good message. Really, he's loved by Bristol, loved by the world. Not that that was always a case. Evidently, he was chased by the police and the authorities. But of late, he's a recognised, esteemed, famous artist. There didn't seem to be much of that in this year. Evidently, most of them were imports. But the worst aspect about, I believe, is the fact that £250,000 for what is a pre-Olympic Olympic experience should not have gone to a street party. It should have gone to the carnival, St Paul's Carnival. They were desperate for money. It's a truly Commonwealth event. It certainly includes children. It includes art, music, you name it. It actually is Bristol. And that was denied the money that could have gone to make a really successful carnival, St Paul's Carnival. And I think it's dreadful to think that this street party actually, in a way, replaced that. It's amazing that the council have so much energy.
Actually, I would have thought, you know, that 250,000, a quarter of a million pounds, is actually enough for both events. I mean, you know, it's not a question of just one or the other. So, I mean, who is it that's actually managed to? I mean, is it the city council that gets this £250,000, or are there specific individuals that have been responsible for taking that Olympiad money and actually administering it and spending it for the See No Evil event?
Well, I think because it seems that John Hurst, as I say, who's one of the directors of Destination Bristol, had a large say in that. He's also a sort of director of commercial ventures. So I guess the money.
Now, hang on, isn't he the same John Hurst who's the manager of Broadmead?
That's right. I presume.
I think it must be the same guy. I mean, there's not a lot of loads of these.
It's possible. Certainly involved in the actual hyping up of Cabot Circus. But the bottom line is the money was, you know, probably given to a number of different agencies. I think on the promotion side, there's Tom Payne from Motion Club and a few other known characters. I would think that maybe 20-30% of the money went to hiring equipment to the scaffold for the painting. Then the artists, some were flown in from America, which I find really quite strange when this is supposed to be a local event for local artists. I'm really, you know, gobsmacked
so
with money.
How did this actually go down amongst people who run venues in the city centre and own shops and this kind of thing?
Well, they were totally excluded. Everything was external. I think there was only one club that got involved, and that was the Lanes. They had some drinking concessions down there, but this, you know, bars like, you know, Art Bar and Syndicate basically weren't invited. So they created new venues for the day, music venues that were unregulated. As I say, it doesn't appear that it was even an alcohol license there, in favour and not actually, and ignored the existing infrastructure, which is totally and utterly licensed.
But I mean, surely you can see that whole site where the old magistrate court used to be is an absolute mess, and surely some sort of art events need to go on there, something to just make the place look a little bit nicer, because it's just falling to pieces, and it's I mean, really a wreck.
Well, I think the idea is for redevelopment. I think what they want to do is probably extend Broadmead into that area. But the good news is the fire station is now an arts and cultural centre.
Oh, the old fire station, yeah.
The old fire station. The rest, I think there's at least 200 or 300 people living above the old magistrate station because it's student accommodation. So all is not
lost. But they're in the middle of a sort of war zone in a way, aren't they? I mean, all around it.
Well, this is where John Hurst comes into it. He is, as I say, he's got a good track record in Cabot Circus, and now he's in Nelson Street, you know. And basically, I just think that the whole See No Evil was just a front for, you know, drumming up business for the property side.
Okay. The other thing is, we've had announcements this week, haven't we, that the government are just going to sort of relax planning regulations. Do you think we might then see a bit of development on those dreadful, like, flattened sites on Temple Way, just near the Evening Post building, where there was a perfectly good clerical medical headquarters that got flattened, and the building opposite it is also flattened? Do you think we might see a little bit of development on these sites now?
I doubt it. I doubt it very much. I mean, one of the reasons for flattening is so they wouldn't have to pay rates. I mean, it's, you know, it really is quite, punishing the amount of rates that an empty property, you know, developer has to pay.
Well, this is when actually, because, I mean, I remember when that was flattened was just a few weeks after Gordon Brown got rid of business rate relief, because for many empty buildings, the people who own them don't pay rates, do they? Because they get business rate relief.
Yes, I mean, on a sustainability ticket, I mean, it's disgraceful the council have allowed that. I mean, we've actually asked the council, did they need permission to pull these perfectly good buildings down? We've yet to hear from that, but no doubt that's another time. But as it stands now, the flattened site is worth a lot more money to a property developer than a set of buildings they can't let.
Martin, can I bring you in here? Because we're in a situation now where the City Council's doing a consultation about who they should charge the new council tax to. They're starting to take away council tax relief because this, is, of course, has replaced the old rating system. ultimately that money is going to be coming for people who are just simply on benefits. So how has this property tax and the local council taxes changed over the years? It seems to have gone from those who are filthy rich, like the people who own the clerical medical site, along to people who are now, it's the people on local benefits live locally, having to pay these local taxes.
Or people on low incomes. I mean, basically, I mean, we're talking about the Thatcher revolution of the poll tax. The poll tax was kicked out in the end because of massive resistance, but the community charge was a halfway house. Previously, we'd had the rating system since the time of Queen Elizabeth I, and the wealthy classes have always hated rates because they're the only ones who pay them. It's people with property who pay rates. And people, for example, who were councillor tenants before the poll tax, they wouldn't even notice they were paying rates because it would be a notional part of their rent. And so they wouldn't actually pay anything, so they wouldn't even think about it. So they would say, go out to an election, say, do we want a youth club? Yes, we'll vote for a youth club. Will we have to pay for it? No, somebody else will pay for it, so we're happy to vote for it. Thatcher was appalled by that, and that's why she went to Streatham and saw all these people in Streatham who were paying for youth clubs in Brixton, and she said, that's not fair, we're going to have to change that. And then that's where the poll tax idea came from. Now, there was a reason why the rates had existed from the time of Elizabeth I until Thatcher. It's because they were the only way, really, to fund local government. That is to say, the people who own the property in the city pump up the money, and then everybody votes how to spend it, including the people who haven't paid in. And of course, that tended to help radical candidates like Chamberlain in the 1890s in Birmingham, who would say, I'm going to provide services to the people, but it's the wealthy who are going to pay. And of course, lots of politicians cut their teeth on doing exactly that. And of course, what's happened now, and it's been a process of going on for a generation, is that the wealthy avoid tax, and that means everybody else has got to pay more, which ultimately strangles the economy, and so we end up where we are, in a mess.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Now, Saddam, Gaddafi and Bashar al-Assad, all Arab leaders who've been accused of bombing their own people, where the Israelis and NATO want to go in on a humanitarian mission to save the people, with disastrous results often and civilian casualties well now into the millions. But is this idea of killing your own people something that originated here in the West? Okay, we hear more now from former Fleet Street journalist and Tory member of the European Parliament for Bristol, Richard Cotterill, as he takes us further into NATO's darkest secret, Operation Gladio, which he's just written a book all about.
There was no Soviet invasion, and so the secret armies, if you like, marked time. But as we went forward, we began to see that the same type of terrorist tactics, and Italy really was the playground of Gladio. Here, that period is known as the Anno di Piombi, which means the years of lead. And so one saw, for example, violent attacks like the one on the Bologna railway station in 1980, which killed 85 people, practically destroyed the station and injured 222 people. These were still old-type Gladio attacks. What we then found was a completely new mission, which arrived with the so-called Islamic peril. A classic example of a Gladio-type attack is 9/11.
The Bologna station, what was the purpose of that attack?
Oh, this was a purely a political trick. At this time, the urban guerrilla outfit known as the Brigati Rosse, in other words, the Red Brigades, were very active, or allegedly active, in Italy. And it was the policy of Italian Christian Democrat governments to keep alive the menace of the Red Peril within. And so within seconds of this bomb going off in Bologna, the worst ever terrorist atrocity in Italy, it was instantly pinned on the Red Brigades, but not for very long. It was rapidly discovered and confirmed by the courts quite a short time afterwards that the bomb, the fatal bomb, had been planted, in fact, by a neo-fascist organization connected to Italian secret services. And this cloaking of terror, one thing to be another, is something which actually goes back to the dawn of the anarchist days. I cover this in the Gladio book, and I call it the propaganda of the deed. In other words, by the propaganda of the deed, you can make people believe something which is advantageous to a particular set of political convictions or a political cause.
Now, one thing that sticks in my mind is the 1980s were also a time of attacks in Britain by so-called Irish Republican gangs. We then found out some of these, certainly a few anyway, were miscarriages of justice, such as the Birmingham 6 and the Guildford 4.
I think those bombs were planted by British intelligence, or by army intelligence, I suspect. But you can also go back to another period about that time, which was the Angry Brigades, if you remember this strange story, which happened at an interlude in British politics, where respectable organs such as the Times rehearsed whether there should be a military coup in the United Kingdom in order to save the nation. Now, that's a very odd period, and I cover this because actually I was reporting it as a journalist, and I remember being sent to the Sabernick Forest to report on the activities of so-called paramilitary guerrillas who were dancing about at the weekend, practicing taking over the state. I interviewed General Sir Walter Walker, who was the former Gladio commander in NATO, down at his cottage in South Petherton in Somerset, and he gave a very interesting interview in which he said he had an army of sleeping soldiers who were ready to rise up in the cause and make sure that the hammer and sickle didn't fly over Buckingham Palace. It was more than ironic that about 20 miles away you could find the hill beneath which King Arthur was supposed to sleep with his men till the trump came. So really there was a great deal of doubt as to who was really behind the Angry Brigades, and we've often said that they seemed to lack the sophisticated skills, certainly with explosives, to do any serious damage, and that this kind of skills were more likely to be found in military quarters. This is an example, interestingly, of a soft assassination. I devote a whole chapter to this in the book. Harry Wilson I knew very well. I must say I greatly admired him, actually. He certainly had his failures, but he was absolutely sure throughout his premierships that he had the Secret Services, particularly MI5, MI6, and CIA, hot on his tail, and ultimately they destroyed him.
Richard Cottrell there, author of Gladio, NATO's Dagger at the Heart of Europe, the Pentagon, Mafia, Nazi, Terror, Axis. Every BCFM show is available online. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Friday Drive Time at 5 o'clock next week, and don't let the banksters get you down.